Okay, excellent. So tonight we're going to speak about Nezikin, tort cases in Beit Din nowadays. The truth of the matter is we could spend a half a year on this subject, obviously, like any of the subjects. But what we want to do is to try to cover just a broad range in terms of a conceptual analysis of how we deal with Nezikin-type cases. People ask me, how does Beis Din deal with the physical assault and battery cases nowadays? How do we deal with other types of Nezikin molestation cases? How do we deal with damage to people's property? How do we deal with medical malpractice suits? How do we deal with the types of things which would be in the realm of Nezikin? Then you would figure that there is some sort of a model as to how Beis Din deals with these cases and nowadays. So the truth of the matter is that Nezikin are not among the most common of Beis Din cases. Not that they don't come up from time to time, but they are generally few and far between. Most of the types of cases that we get are cases of contract disputes, cases of bail partnerships, cases of unpaid broker fees, cases of employer-employee disputes, a lot of the stuff, landlord-tenant disputes, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about up until now. We don't get so many physical battery-type cases. We get from time to time property damage type cases, but it's more in a specific realm of, say, skilus poalim type of cases where there is a worker who's hired to do a job, and there's a claim that the worker not only didn't do a good job, but really messed up things so badly that it caused damage. But that's in a very specific and narrow realm in which the main consideration has to be more in the sphere of, does the worker deserve to get paid? How much does the worker deserve to get paid, etc., etc., as opposed to a pure damage case. You can also have damages in the realm of automobile accidents. So how many automobile accident cases come to Beis Din? So I'm going to explain, first of all, why not so many of these types of cases come to Beis Din, what the reason for that is. And then I'm going to give a basic description of the manner in which we do or would approach cases that do come in front of us. First of all, how do we know that there's such a realm as tort cases? Well, of course we know that there's such a thing because much of Baba Kama is devoted to it. We have very, specific cases of oxen that are goring each other, in the Torah, and we have applications of the principle. But how do we know that when a person damages another person or a person damages property, that there is some sort of a chiyuv? There is no actual pasuk in the Torah that would seem to indicate that a mazik is usur altogether. In other words, what is the isur of causing damage to another person? There is no pasuk that says that lo yazik. There's no pasuk that says lo yazik, that you're not allowed to cause damage. So there is a robust discussion amongst the many of the commentators regarding what is the source of the isur mazik. So one source is that of the Torah, who says, well, the Torah says lo tignov, lo sigzo, you're not allowed to steal. So if you're not allowed to steal somebody's property, certainly you're not allowed to cause an outright hezek, an outright damage to the person's property or to the person's body. It's almost like a kal vachomer. The Levush says that this is an expansion of the prohibition of Baal Tashkos, that you're not allowed to wantonly destroy property. So certainly you're not allowed to, if the property doesn't belong to anybody, it's just a fruit tree, for example. So certainly the property belongs to somebody, and certainly if it's the person themselves, that would be prohibited. The Yad Ramah says that it's an expansion of the prohibition of you're not allowed to place a stumbling block in front of a blind person, so certainly you're not allowed to punch the blind person in the face, right? So that would be sort of an expansion of that. And also clearly it's a violation of Ve'avta L'Re'echa Kamocha if you're going to go around hurting people. Although we'll see that a mazik, a person who causes damage, is liable even if they do it ba'onis, even if they do it without any intention whatsoever. The Kilas Yaakov, the stipler Gon, in the beginning of Baba Kama has a long essay on the Yisra Mazik, and he says that it is expanded from Hashavas Aveda, that it is considered to be a manifestation or application of the fact that we're supposed to return to people that which they have lost, The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Gimel, says that also means that if a person is unwell, that we're supposed to restore them to their previous physical state. That we're supposed to help people who are physically incapacitated get better. So certainly we're not supposed to hurt them in the first place. So that would be an Isser Mazik. And the Ksam Sofer says that it is an expansion, and this is also similar to what Rabbi Yosef Be'er Soloveitchik said, that it is a violation of Lo Samen Al Dam Riecha, that you're not allowed to stand idly by your brother's blood if somebody is getting hurt. You have to help them, so certainly you shouldn't hurt them in the first place. All of these different answers and explanations as to what the Isser Mazik derives from, you'll find in the Sefer Shaari Mishpat, in his footnotes. He has a very nice discussion of all of these different sources. So whatever it is, it's important for us to know that it is some sort of an Isser D'oraisa, because once we establish that it's an Isser D'oraisa, it means that even when we have a suffix, it's going to be usher. So you have to really stay far away from even the possibility that you're going to end up causing physical harm. So now let's talk about why it is that in many of these cases, I mentioned car crashes, I mentioned medical malpractice cases, why is it that Beis Din doesn't end up lemaise adjudicating many of these cases? So from the two examples that I gave you, you can figure out very readily, because most people are covered by insurance when it comes to these cases. Even if there's damage which is done, let's say I accidentally do damage to your property. So people have homeowners insurance, there's homeowners insurance, there's car insurance, there's medical malpractice insurance. So people will generally want to go after the insurance companies, because the insurance companies have the deep pockets, and we understand that if there is a liability, that if there's damage which is caused, and the damager is going to be able to be covered by their insurance, or the damagee will be able to cover from their insurance. So generally speaking, it's going to be the insurance company that's going to get involved in the case. The insurance companies, by and large, are owned by non-Jews, or are primarily owned by non-Jews. They're not, whether they're credit unions or not, like we spoke about last week, that's not relevant to this analysis. They're simply non-Jewish entities. And we know as a general rule, it's mutter to take a non-Jewish entity to secular court. Of course, if the non-Jewish entity would come to you and say, I'm prepared to adjudicate the case in Beis Din, so the Tashbetz was of the opinion that it lost achen chol goyim mishpatim ba'ayir de'um aluka, that even when you're dealing with non-Jews, you really should adjudicate the cases in Beis Din if they're willing to adjudicate in Beis Din. It's just that we generally assume they're not willing to adjudicate in Beis Din. So if you take a look, yes, question.
Everybody seems to know that the insurance company is involved. They're going to write the check, whatever science is appropriate. Why is it that it's forbidden to mention the insurance company in open court because there's grounds for mistrial?
So let's take a look about that. Take a look at the first source. That was J. David Blythe, Contemporary Halakhic Problems. Okay? So he says like this. He says that despite the fact that it is the tortfeasor rather than the insurance company who is the named defendant, and that any mention of insurance coverage in the courtroom may be grounds for a mistrial, what do you know? The real party in interest is the insurance company. So says Rabbi Bleich that despite all of these realities, we all know that whatever the court may impose in terms of their rules of a procedure, we all know that the real party in interest is the insurance company. Yes, it's true. The caption of the case will say plaintiff party, the aggrieved party, versus a defendant, and that will be the individual who's covered by the insurance company. You're not allowed to name the insurance company as the defendant in the lawsuit, but we all know for our purposes, Alpi Halacha, it's really the insurance company that's going to be on one. It's the insurance company's lawyer that's going to defend the suit. It's the insurance company that is going to end up doing the payout if there is any kind of liability. So therefore, it is common knowledge that most people carry insurance for claims of such nature, since it is readily perceived that the cause of action in these types of cases, car crashes, medical malpractice, and the like, is really against a non-Jewish insurance company that will not appear before Beis Din. Now again, the assumption here that Rabbi Bleich is making and that we generally would make is that the insurance company is not prepared to appear before the Beis Din because they sort of know what their odds of success or failure are going to be in the civil court. That's their place of comfort. Why would they want to subject themselves to the vagaries or the unknowns of appearing before a different legal system where, for all they know, maybe their course risk analysis is faulty in terms of how much they're going to have to end up paying? So since it is perceived that they will not appear before Beis Din, it would appear that judicial proceedings in such circumstances do not constitute either a renunciation of the law of Moses. What's the reason why it's prohibited to go to civil court? It's because Yemeirim Yad neged Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, or voluntary aggrandizement of a non-halachic legal system, or your miyakir as ha'elilim, your miyakir, you give aggrandizement to the idolatrous legal systems, and hence such suits are not forbidden. So therefore, since you don't run afoul of either of those considerations, you're not going against the law of Moses, because you are going after a non-Jewish entity that would not come to Bez Din anyway. You're not recognizing their legal system. It's just that you have no choice but to bring the case to secular court. Therefore, says Rabbi Bleich, there is no violation when it's the insurance company that we know is going to be on the line and bringing the case in secular court. So the reality is that the vast majority of the cases, medical malpractice cases, car crash cases, things of that sort, where we know that the party that committed the harm is covered by insurance coverage, the plaintiff is going to go after the insurance company, and therefore they will go straight to secular court. So they have the right to go to secular court. According to Rabbi Black, they have the right to go to secular court. And I'm not aware of really any, or I'm not aware of a significant cadre of a poskim who rule otherwise, meaning that in general this appears to be the psak halacha. I once asked Rabbi Bleich where you could find many any mekoros for this notion prior to when he published his essay on the subject, and if I recall correctly, he was proud of the fact that he was the first person to, you know, put this down on paper. But he said that he thought it was a davar pashut. Apparently, both Rav Shach and Rav El Yashiv thought it was a davar pashut too, because in the 11th volume of the Yeshurun volume of the Yeshurun Journal, you will see that there are. There was a question that was posed by Yitzchak Zilberstein. Yitzchak Zilberstein, we know, is he's a Gaon Atzum, and he is the son-in-law, I believe, of Rav El Yashiv, right? He married a daughter of Rav El Yashiv. Yitzchak Zilberstein posed a question to both Rav Shach and then afterwards to his father-in-law, to Rav El Yashiv, about whether it was appropriate for somebody who was harmed by a doctor's negligence in a medical malpractice suit to go after the malpractice insurance carrier in a secular court, in Israeli secular court, in the Beit Mishpat, rather than to take the doctor to the Beis Din. So there were two parts of his question. One was the question of, is there an ability to collect from a doctor who did not willfully cause any damage, who just made a mistaken judgment? This was a case where the doctor made a mistaken judgment, delivered a baby through through normal birth rather than through a cesarean section, and it became clear in retrospect that the baby would have been much better off with a cesarean section because it was a natural birth. Based on the way that the baby came out, the baby suffered significant damage, and it gave grounds to a medical malpractice suit. But in halacha, we have a general principle. This is found in the Tosefta, and Gittin, Baba Kama discuss, different Toseftas discuss a general principle that we give, based on Tikkun HaOlam, we give a pass to a doctor that's just doing his job or her job according to the normal protocols, is using their best judgment. They make a mistake, but they make a mistake just using their best judgment, that we let them off the hook. At least from liability b'day adam, we let them off the hook, unless there's gross negligence. There seem to be indications that if it was gross negligence, then they would be liable. But short of gross negligence, a doctor is generally off the hook, because it's a tikkun ha'olam, explains the Tosefta, that if not, people would not want to be doctors. People wouldn't want to be doctors. The Ramban talks about this in his Torah Sa'adam, and therefore we give a greater amount of dispensation to a doctor as long as there is not gross negligence. So says Rosh Hashanah, if it would only be in a Bez Din type of setting, so then you wouldn't be able to go after the doctor. However, he says, go on in the second line, that's only if you're going after the doctor himself. But if the doctor is covered by insurance, so then you're not taking anything away. Even if you go to the Arkos and you're going to get money that you wouldn't have been able to get in a bezin from the doctor, since it's all part of a contractual relationship where the doctors enter into these insurance agreements, where the insurance companies contractually agree that they're going to pay money whenever there would be liability found according to secular standards. Therefore, it's a contractual obligation, and you can go after the insurance companies because the insurance companies are not going to go to business. That's why he says, "V'gam ein b'zeh mishum halicha la'arkos." because he says whenever you have any kind of a case with a non-Jew, you're allowed to make the claim against the non-Jew in the civil court. Similarly, there was a second question. The second question was whether if you're going to go to the civil courts, it's going to cause corollary damage to the doctor. In what form? That the doctor is going to lose their good reputation because it will be known that they lost that in medical malpractice suit. That can't be good for the doctor's reputation. So is it mutter for a yid to take the doctor or through the insurance company to secular court, even if it would otherwise be mutter, if it's going to have this corollary negative effect on the doctor's reputation? So that's Rav Yashiv. So Rav Yashiv felt that this was similar to a Tosfos that said that if a Yisrael has a valid claim against an Akum, this is a case where they paid money for a real estate transaction and didn't end up getting the real estate because some Jew ended up grabbing the real estate before the shtar was written, and since the transaction was only concluded with the shtar according to our laws, therefore the Nechasim ended up being Hefker despite the fact that the Jew had already paid the money to the Akum. So he's going to go after the Akum to get the money back. What's the Akum going to do? He's going to grab the property away from the Jew who had taken the property from the first fellow. So even though the Nakhli is now going to go after the Jew who, according to Halakha, had the right to grab the property, he says that's okay. So Tosfos said that that's perfectly okay since it's a legitimate claim that's being registered against the Akum. One second. So here too, there's a legitimate claim which is being registered against the insurance company. So even though there's going to be collateral damage, so to speak, to the Yisrael doctor, it's not something you have to worry about with Prat. And he throws in another detail. Let me just finish this line. Because the doctor knows that when he enters into the insurance policy, that this is going to be the consequence, that there will be cases where the insurance company and his good name are going to be dragged through the court. That's how he entered LASIK Rafua. When he enters into the medical profession, he understands every doctor has to get medical malpractice insurance, and because of the medical malpractice insurance, there will be patients that will take advantage of the medical malpractice laws in order to pursue cases for medical malpractice against this doctor in secular court going against the insurance company. And it's Aldaz Kane, it's with that understanding that he enters into the practice, so he knows that his name and reputation might be sullied. It's almost like an implied Mechila Meirosh. Okay, question.
Well, the attorney who represents the insurance company is the only attorney representing that side of the equation. He's directed by the insurance company. And I assume he's given a budget saying, don't go over a million, don't go over this, or that. I think it's wrong because you cannot bring the insurance company in and say to them, did you give Mr. Jones, the attorney, strict instructions not to go to give this case any dollar amount above a certain amount? Did you tell him that? Okay, I know we would shake up the legal profession immensely, okay, but it seems to me that the attorney doesn't have a free handle here. In other words, he's told ahead of time, this is what the case is worth to us, and don't go above that number.
That's probably true in any kind of liability case, so where the insurance company is prepared to pay a certain amount, at least for settlement purposes. Of course, sometimes an insurance company will take a calculated risk and let it go to a jury verdict, or a court verdict, where there's a possibility that they'll lose a lot more than what they're willing to put on the line because they are not satisfied with any of the settlement proposals that the other side is offering. So that's just a calculated risk. That's sort of a different story. But here there's a question. There's a fundamental question. And let me raise the question. And that is that let's say that the doctor says, I would rather that this case be brought to Bezdin because of the fact that I don't want to subject myself, even through insurance coverage, to the liability of a court case, or maybe because I just feel that I would trust the Bezdin process more, so even though my insurance carrier is not going to pay for my liability if the case is adjudicated in Bezdin, I'll take my chances. So maybe it'll be a $2 million verdict that the Bezdin will meet out. On the other hand, I learned the Tosefta, I learned the various sugyas, and I think that because I used my best judgment that the Bezdin will probably let me off the hook altogether, so maybe, therefore, it's better for me to just adjudicate this in Bezdin and take my chances, even though I won't have insurance coverage. So would the plaintiffs still have the right to pursue this case in civil court against the insurance company. So I think the answer is, to take a look at Rabbi Blackman, Blackman says, well, the insurance company is the real party in interest, that the answer is yes, because of the fact that the plaintiff is basically taking advantage of this contractual obligation on the part of the insurance company. That's for the benefit of anybody out there who ends up being a victim in this, with respect to the medical treatment. And therefore, it is the right of the plaintiff to pursue the insurance company. And in fact, you can look at it through the following prism. Let's say that there is somebody who would owe me money, a borrower who would owe me money, and the borrower, when they signed the promissory note, I said, I don't trust that the borrower is going to be good for their debt, so I want somebody to guarantee the debt. And somebody else signs off as a guarantor. And now, the borrower is not paying. So, am I obligated to only go after the borrower, or can I go after the guarantor? So we say it depends. There are three different types of arevs. There are three different types of guarantors. There's an arev stam, regular guarantor, and you're not allowed to go after that regular guarantor until you have already pursued and exhausted your remedy of going after the borrower. Then there's an arev kablan. Arev kablan means you can take your choice. You can either go after the borrower, you can go after the guarantor. And then there's an arev shluchtutz. What's an arev shluchtutz? Arev shluchtutz means that you're only allowed to go after the guarantor, and you're not allowed to go after the borrower. So it seems to me that given that everybody understands that when you're covered by medical insurance, or that when you're a doctor, you have to be covered by medical insurance, a person goes in for any procedure with a doctor, they generally understand that their remedy is not going to be against the doctor, but it's going to be against the insurance company. I think the insurance company probably is like an arev shluchtutz. But if an arev insurance company is not like an arev shluchtutz, it's at least like an arev kablan, and therefore the plaintiff has the right to go either after the borrower, if it would be an arev kablan, or after the insurance company. So according to either one of those models, it would be perfectly legitimate. Even if the plaintiff is screaming, take me to Bezdin, take me to Bezdin, for the insurance company to say, for the plaintiff to say, no, I'm going to go after the insurance company instead in the civil court. So we have those types of cases, but sometimes it can work the other way. What do you mean the other way? Well, this is a case where the plaintiff wants to bring the case to a civil court, right? Well, the plaintiff wants to bring the case to civil court, so we say that the plaintiff has the right to bring the case to civil court. What if the defendant says, I want you to go after my insurance company in a civil court, and the plaintiff says, no, I want to go to Bezdin. Okay, let's say you would have that type of a scenario. Just imagine that it's just the reverse situation. It's the defendant that says that I don't want to be on the line in Bezdin. I want you to take my insurance company to civil court. And the plaintiff says, no, I want to take you to Bezdin. I feel that this matter should be adjudicated in Bezdin. So then, if I look at that same Arev model, the same guarantor model, if I would view the insurance company as an Arev kablan, where the understanding is that you could go either after the defendant, in this case after the doctor, or after the insurance company. So then, from a plaintiff's perspective, a plaintiff has the right on insisting that they're going to go after the insurance company as opposed to the Bezdin. But a defendant doesn't have the right to say, you plaintiff must take me to, must go after my insurance company. The plaintiff would presumably have the right to say, no, you're an Arev kablan, or the insurance company is an Arev kablan. I could go either after the insurance company, or I can go after you and go straight to Bezdin. So this comes up actually not so much in the context of medical malpractice claims, because I think you can make a very strong argument to the effect that in a medical malpractice suit, that since everybody enters into their medical treatments with the understanding that ultimately the insurance company will be responsible, it's really an Arev Shluchtutz. So if they're really an Arev Shluchtutz, so then even the defendant in a case has the right of saying, don't go after me in Bezdin, go after me in civil court when the insurance company is going to be held responsible. Similarly, with car crashes, you could say the same thing. Everybody knows you go out on the road, you're not allowed to drive your vehicle unless you have insurance. So therefore, every single driver knows if there's going to be a crash, even if the other party was grossly negligent, that your claim is going to be after the insurance company. So therefore, even if you want to take the defendant to Bezdin, the Bezdin says, don't go take me to Bezdin, take my insurance company to civil court. Presumably the defendant has the right to do that. I've had cases, though, where it's not so clear that the insurance company would be an Arif Shluchtus. What's a similar type of case like that? We spoke about employment disputes. So with employment disputes, we mentioned that sometimes you'll have a claim according to halacha. An employee will have a claim against the employer according to halacha for not paying severance, for example, because maybe there's a minhag of paying severance, but if there was no clear contractual obligation to pay severance, they're not going to have the same claim in civil court. And what some employers, even of Jewish institutions, even of Torah institutions, have started to do is to purchase insurance for labor disputes. And that says that if there's a labor dispute, so then the insurance company will pay for whatever damages there are. But those insurance companies, generally speaking, will only want to go to civil court. So I've had a couple of cases where an employee got fired and he said, I want to go to Beis Din against my employer, the yeshiva, or the whatever, you know, Jewish institution it was, because I feel that I'm entitled to a Jewish obligation of severance. And the employer said, no, I'm sorry, we're covered by insurance. We're covered by insurance, and therefore you have to file suit in civil court. And the employee knows that they don't have a shot in civil court. And so it's almost like this catch-22 situation, that they'll have the right, and it's just to go to civil court, but they're not going to be able to pick anything up in civil court. So in this case, there's a much stronger argument to make that the insurance carrier is not an Arif Shluchtus, because it's not as if when you go to work as an employee in a Jewish institution that there's an expectation that everybody knows that if there's ever going to be an employment dispute that you're going to be limited to recovery in civil court against the insurance carrier, because everything ultimately is going to be covered by insurance. Many places and institutions don't have insurance carriers, and many, certainly in a Jewish institution, a Rebbe or something like that would go into the job with the expectation that their remedies will be defined according to halacha, not according to labor law as defined in the civil court. So there, unless there's an explicit stipulation at the time that the employment begins, this is the way we do things in our school, and when you sign up, you're signing up that any labor dispute is going to be handled by the insurance carrier, and you'll be limited to any recovery you can get by the insurance carrier who follows secular law, I would think that the defendant certainly would have the right to say, no, the plaintiff in that case would have the right to say that I do not want to be restricted to going into the civil courts against the insurance carrier, but I want to still preserve my right to go into the Beis Din. Now, we had a case, interestingly, in the Beis Din a number of years ago, a medical malpractice case, where the person who was treated, the patient, felt that the doctor had committed malpractice and wanted to take the doctor to Beis Din. Actually wanted to take the doctor to Beis Din. It's very, very interesting. And The person who was the standard case, that wouldn't make so much sense. The patient, of course, wanted to take the doctor to civil court because that's where you could get a much greater recovery in terms of the medical malpractice claim. But the doctor wanted to go to Beis Din. The doctor wanted to go to Beis Din. So you'll say that according to the principles that I just articulated, the doctor shouldn't have the right to do that because this could be an Arif Shluchtus type of situation where it was a contractual understanding that the only remedy that a patient would have would be against the insurance carrier. But what happened was the insurance carrier said, you know what? We're prepared to submit ourselves to the Beis Din. The insurance carrier in that case said, we're prepared to submit ourselves to the Beis Din. So the defendant said, look, the insurance carrier is prepared to subject themselves to the Beis Din. So therefore, what right does the plaintiff have to insist that they're going to still pursue this case in civil court as opposed to the Beis Din? So most poskim would say that in that type of scenario, there really would be the right for the defendant to insist that the case be adjudicated in Beis Din because the insurance carrier is prepared to submit themselves to the Beis Din. It's interesting. The case came in front of Avidaya Dov Schwartz, Shlita Rabbi Schwartz, happened to rule in that particular case that the plaintiff still had the right to go after the insurance company in a civil court. So I think that his reasoning was that he explained at the time, if I recall correctly, was that it just seemed suspicious to him. It just didn't make any sense to him. Now, why would the insurance carrier be comfortable adjudicating in Beis Din when their comfort level was in the secular court system? So I think that he just felt that it wasn't something that was trustworthy under the circumstances, and that's why he didn't allow it. But As a general rule and as a general principle, I would say that if the insurance carrier is prepared to go to Beis Din, then the Beis Din would generally insist that the case be adjudicated in Beis Din. But the question would be, and maybe this is part of what Rav Schwartz was getting at, would the result be any different? Meaning that would the Beis Din in such a case adjudicate the case according to just what the halakha would allow? Or would we say that since the insurance carrier in general obligates itself to pay according to whatever the secular law would obligate it to pay, that there was a contractual commitment on the part of the doctor that the doctor is prepared to subject himself or herself to whatever liability would be imposed upon the insurance company based on medical malpractice law? So some of the posts can say yes, there would be, that would be part of what is included in the insurance coverage, that liability would still be attached. It's just that liability would now be adjudicated by Beis Din as opposed to adjudicated by secular court. For example, there's a similar idea, the Piskei Choshen discusses in the car crash type of context. Let's say that there is a car crash and the person who would recover the insurance from, let's say, one party was clearly negligent and the other party would recover from the insurance company of the negligent driver. And the negligent driver says, you know what, I really don't want my premiums to go up, so please don't file an insurance claim. I'll just take care of it. Let's go to Beis Din, where we're just going to keep it out of the insurance world, and I'll take care of it that way. So what is the obligation in terms of how much has to be paid? So the Piskei Choshen says that he thinks that in this particular case, you can make a strong argument that when the person who would otherwise be able to collect in from the insurance carrier is asked to give up that right and to simply accept payment out of pocket by the negligent driver, that the negligent driver is obligated. It's almost as if they are then taking the position where they are serving as the guarantor of the insurance company. They're saying, don't go to the insurance company to collect from them, to collect from me, in which case they would be obligated to pay the full amount that the insurance company would otherwise pay. So therefore, you could even go so far as to say that if the insurance carrier was not willing to go to Beis Din, and we ended up adjudicating the case in Beis Din because the plaintiff wanted to go to Beis Din, the defendant doctor wanted to go to Beis Din, and the plaintiff says, okay, you want to go to Beis Din and not subject yourself or not take advantage of your insurance coverage, so I will take you to Beis Din instead. Basically, in such a case, you could argue, based on the Piskei Choshen's reasoning, that the doctor is saying, yes, don't take me to, say, civil court, because I don't want my insurance premiums to go up, but I will pay you in Beis Din whatever it is that my insurance carrier would otherwise have been willing to pay you. So you can make that argument as well. Okay.
Are those Israeli insurance companies, and would that be considered Jewish owned?
No, that they were assuming that even there, it's interesting. If you take a look at the Chubos by Rav Shach and Rav Yosh, I think Rav Shach said that most people, well, I don't know about the facts, this was written obviously when Rav Shach was still alive. He was passed away in the year of 2002. When did he pass away? 2005? No, 2001. Since Rav Shach passed away in 2001. So Rav Shach said that in the course of his tshuva, he said, as everybody knows, most of the doctors are covered by this insurance, insurance plan, which comes from England. And this is an insurance plan which is provided by this large insurance carrier located in England, and all of them are non-Jewish, and this is Yadua. So I don't know if that's still the case, but that was the reality that they were assuming in the context of that particular tshuva. It's a good question, though. Okay, so that's reason number one why we don't end up with many of these types of liability or tort liability cases, because many of them, if you're talking about medical malpractice, if you're talking about car crashes, so many of them are covered by insurance, and therefore they don't end up being adjudicated by Beis Din. But there's a second reason. The second reason is, let's say that we're talking about an assault and battery case. Or let's say we're talking about where somebody is accused of molesting a child. We're talking about like child molestation or something like that. It's not going to generally end up in Beis Din because there's a criminal component. And the Dvar Avraham, in the first Chelek of Shuvah, his very first Shuvah, in a footnote, says that whenever you're dealing with criminal matters are subject to Dina D'Malchusa Dina, they're subject to the governmental oversight to be in charge of, as Donald Trump might say, maintaining law and order. That is part of the government's responsibility, is that they have to maintain law and order. It's a governmental responsibility. Even when we talk about Beis Din being makin ve'onshin shelo min hadin, that's based on Beis Din having that type of a governmental function to maintain law and order. But in many countries, it's not delegated to a Beis Din. It is a power which is maintained by the government authorities to be the ones to instill and institute law and order, and therefore they get to be in charge of criminal cases. Criminal cases are not really against Reuven and Shimon. Reuven says, "Oh, Shimon hit me, so I'm bringing a case against Shimon." Reuven goes to the government and says, "Shimon hit me," and the government brings a claim against Shimon. It's between the government and Shimon. So therefore, many of these physical assault and battery cases end up being adjudicated in court. Similarly, child molestation cases, very dangerous for Beis Din to touch because they're really criminal cases. So you'll say, well, Beis Din can touch the monetary aspects of the case. Like, for example, there's repoy that a person was assaulted, they were molested, a child was molested, now they have to pay therapy bills the rest of their life because they were so traumatized by the incident, right? So that's something which certainly can be brought in Beis Din. That's a monetary matter, but it's a monetary claim which is inextricably attached to the criminal claim. So most of these types of cases can't really be bifurcated. The only time I remember I was called by one of the askanim in the community about, can we work out a system for the Beis Din to handle these types of cases, at least in terms of enforcing or in terms of issuing judgments for repoy, for having to pay medical bills and things of that sort. I said yes, but only if the case can be bifurcated. We can't hear the initial case as to whether there was molestation or not on a criminal level. If it's already been adjudicated and criminal molestation or criminal liability has been found, then the liability, the monetary part of the case regarding what the damages should be, could be brought in Beis Din afterwards. But we can't hear the entire case in the totality. It would have to be capable of being bifurcated. So since many such cases are not so easily capable of being bifurcated, this is another reason why many of these types of nezik cases or of tort cases don't end up being in the Beis Din. So that's
like
reason number. That's reason number two.
Like the two OJ cases, the criminal and then later the civil.
Correct. If you could bifurcate it, then that could work. Now number three. Reason number three, which is less of a compelling reason, but it's perhaps a misconception on some level, is we've discussed in the past, the Beis Din jurisdiction is limited, Bisman has said, right? That the only jurisdiction that Beis Din really has to adjudicate cases, we said, is with respect to Milsa lo Shkicha, V'yesh Bo Chisaron Kis. Milsa de Shkicha, V'yesh Bo Chisaron Kis. Cases which are common, and where there's an out-of-pocket cost. So many of the physical liability cases, the Shulchan Aruch in this first Siman of Kol Shemishpa says the Reuven punches Shimon and causes nezik, that's considered to be a milsa de lo shkicha. It's considered to be uncommon. I hope it's uncommon. Because it's uncommon, it doesn't fall into classical Beis Din jurisdiction. And there's the discussion with respect to other matters as well that are not considered to be common. There's an opinion of there's a machlokis between the Shach and the Shavus Yaakov, for example, as to whether Niske Eshu Bor are considered to be Milsa D'Shkicha. If there are cases where somebody dug a pit in the Rishus HaRabim and somebody fell in the pit and got hurt, so is that considered to be a common case? Is it not considered to be a common case, right? So we have over here, for example, the Piskei Tshuva is of the opinion that we do adjudicate such cases, and the Shach is of the opinion that we don't adjudicate such cases. So there's a machlokas about it. So I remember that I had a situation once where there was a father of a boy who was driving a bicycle and it fell into a pit, or it fell into a pothole that was in a bungalow colony that was owned by a particular individual, and they wanted to go after that individual in civil court. And that person said, "I don't have insurance coverage." I don't know if that's right or wrong that he didn't have insurance coverage, but he didn't have insurance coverage. So he said, "So what are you going after me in civil court? There's no insurance company to go after. So go after me in Beis Din instead." And the plaintiff had a toin. And the toin had a very creative argument. The toin said, because we see that there is an opinion that says that that this type of a nezek, which is nezek bor, is not subject to shlichusayoka avinon, therefore Bezin doesn't have jurisdiction, and therefore we have the right to pursue this matter in civil court. So that's a misconception. That would say, oh, there are many liability cases. Nezek, for example, a man, you know, hurts another man. Behema bites a man. That's also said in Shulchan Aruch to be something which is a milsa delo shchicha. Right? Dog bites man is considered milsa delo shchicha. Man bites dog is considered milsa de shchicha. But, okay, just look at the Shulchan Aruch. Obviously, it just means that people are more likely to cause, you know, damages to property than the animals are likely to cause the damage to the people. However, despite the fact that all of these different types of nezikin, of torts, of a direct nezik, of damage that a behemoth causes to a person, etc., many of these different damages, according to some opinions, in this case, Eshu Bor, are not subject to Shlikusayo. That doesn't mean that you don't have to go to Beis Din. If we take a look at the Beis Yosef in Source 6, Beis Yosef quotes the Baal Trumas. He says, even Dibene Chavalos, even the types of cases with this physical battery, which are not technically included within Shlikusayo, that doesn't mean you have the right to go to our calls. Maybe you're stuck, you can't go anywhere. But to the extent that you have a claim, Reuven has a claim against Shimon, a Jew has a monetary claim against another Jew, he has to go to Beis Din. Beis Din may say we can't adjudicate it, or Beis Din will say we're going to make a knas. We can't just decide according to strict law, but we're going to make a knas. We're going to penalize, we're going to require Reuven, who was struck, who was physically struck by Shimon, we're going to require him to appease Shimon, to give him an amount of money sufficient to appease Shimon, but without necessarily evaluating exactly how much he has been harmed through the physical assault according to the strict din, but they can decide according to not what's the strict din, or they can refer the case to civil court if they think that that's the right remedy, but it has to first come into the Beis Din. It's interesting because Rav Avram Sherman wanted to argue, he's a dayan in the Beis Din Agadol in Eretz Yisrael, so he wanted to argue, he wrote a piece about insurance coverage, and he wanted to argue that in any case in which the defendant is covered by insurance coverage, the plaintiff is obligated in all of those cases to first go to Beis Din for the Beis Din to make a determination as to whether there should be the right to go after the insurance company in that case or not. But most of the authorities didn't follow Rav Sherman because of what Rabbi Black said, because they felt in that case, the insurance company is already the party in interest, as opposed to in this case, where the insurance company is not the party in interest, where it is the two Jews who are the parties in interest. It's just the question, does Beis Din have jurisdiction or not? So when it's the Jews, clearly the party in interest, you have no right to go to civil court, even if Shikusai was not putting it. You go to Beis Din, and Beis Din will determine if it can somehow, if it can concoct some other remedy that's appropriate within the realm of its modern day jurisdiction. But that's a very important nekuda as to, you know, how in this particular domain, in the Shlikusayo domain, even if a case doesn't fall within Shlikusayo, in the Nezikin realm, it still would have to go to Beis Din first if it doesn't fall into the other categories of either having the insurance company as a party in interest or being the type of case that falls within the criminal domain. Now, what are actual cases which do come into the jurisdiction of Beis Din in the context of Nezikin? So first, I just want to review one basic principle in Nezikin, because you can't talk about Nezikin without at least commenting on this very important machlokas. There's a machlokas between the Tosos and the Ramban. When it comes to Nezikin, this is in Baba Metzia, Daf Pei Beis, Amud Beis, you'll find both the Tosos and the Ramban over there. And that is that we have a principle in the Gemara that Adam Mu'ad Li'olam, that a person is always considered to be culpable for the direct harm that he causes to another person's body or to another person's property. It's the principle of Adam Mu'ad Li'olam. You find it in the materials in Source 7. It's derived from Petzah Tachas Patzah, L'chayev al Ones Kiratzon. So Tosfos argues that this is not an absolute principle. This is only when there is like an accident, we say a person is responsible for an accident. But if it is an onus gomor, it is the type of accident that there's no way in the world that a person could have protected themselves against the accident. You went to sleep at night, and there was no lamp next to your bed when you went to sleep at night. Somebody put a lamp next to your bed. It was just like a nice gesture. It's a hotel, whatever. They want to put a lamp next to your bed so that you'll be able to have it if you should want to turn on the lamp. But you did not expect the lamp to be there next to your bed, and therefore it was not not on your mind when you went to sleep at night. Then you twisted it, then you tossed and turned in your sleep, and you knocked over the lamp. But it wasn't even there when you went to, you couldn't even have known about it. It wasn't in your consciousness. So that's what we call an onus gomer. And Yerushalmi talks about that case. Since that's an onus gomer, so therefore Tosfos says, we see that you're putter from that particular case, so you're putter from any kind of onus gomer. And the Ramban says that, no, you're not putter from onus gomer. Even onus gomer, even if it's an absolute accident, the person is still going to be chai for an absolute accident. And all the cases that we speak about, somebody put a lamp there afterwards, those are all cases where there was a pshia, where somebody else was negligent to you know, put something next to you when you happen to be in a position where you could have caused potential harm. But whenever there is not a pshia element behind it, so then even if it is an onus gomer, complete accident, you're still going to be chayev. So that's a pretty broad range of liability. The Shulchan Aruch seems to paskin, certainly the Ramah, but the Shulchan Aruch as well seems to paskin like Tosfos, that if you have an onus gomer, you're not liable. You're walking up a ladder. The ladder was a very, very safe ladder. It was checked and everything, and then suddenly it caves in as you're walking up the ladder and you fall down and you don't kill somebody, but you hurt somebody. So the Shulchan Aruch says you're not going to be liable in that case because that's an onus gomer. So we see that we basically pass like Tosfos against the Ramban. But if it would just be a regular onus, a regular accident, so generally speaking, you're going to be chayev. So it's an interesting discussion in the Shevet Alevi. Look in Source Yud Gimel. He talks about a person who's driving a car and he falls asleep in the car. Because he falls asleep in the car, he hits somebody and he causes terrible damage to that person. So, leaving aside the insurance question, the question is the Shena considered to be onus? Is that considered to be in the category where we would say that's like an onus gomer? Is that considered to be a complete accident that the person has no control over? So he says, and even if we say that it's just a regular onus, it still has a nafkamina, there would still be ramifications to halacha. Take a look at the second line in Source 13. Mashena mashena together onus bovad l'chayim rak menezik. If it's onus, okay, let's say it's not onus gomer, but it's onus, so then you'd only be obligated to pay for, when we say adam mu'av yolam, that means in terms of the wounds that you caused to, let's say, the person. But let's say the ancillary damage, the medical bills. Love reaper wounds just means that, you know, he used to be worth $100,000 on the slave market and now you caused his arm to fall off, so he's only worth $80,000 on the slave market, so you pay him $20,000. But it doesn't mean you have to pay for the medical bills. Medical bills you only have to pay for if there's some degree of negligence, right? Below Beripoy, we wouldn't have to pay medical bills. Oh, who together onus called the Pshia? Or do we say, no, there's negligence involved, so therefore he'd be obligated in medical bills as well. So one of the people who was engaged in this debate said, this is an onus gomer. What are you talking about? A person falls asleep at the wheel? Yeah, what kind of responsibility should that entail? It's an onus gomer. This is sort of a strange argument because the Rambam, for example, says if you're drunk, a person who's drunk has absolutely no control if they're really, really drunk over what they do, but if they cause damage, then they're still liable. Why are they still liable? So the Maharshal explains, because the Choberia, that you're not going to, everybody will just get drunk and do whatever damage they want, so, you know, because they're drunk, and nobody will ever be responsible because people will feel, okay, I can just get drunk and I won't be responsible. Responsible for anything that I do. So therefore we say that we don't allow that. So presumably the same argument should pertain to drowsy driving, that we can't permit drowsy driving. But this rabbi wanted to argue, no, this is like a person who falls from a roof when there is a sudden, unexpected, and unforecasted, incredible hurricane, which is an onus gomer, so the person should be potentially off the hook. Okay, so the Shevet Alevi says like this. He says, I think that if he fell asleep at the very beginning of the trip, so then there was something wrong with his preparation for the trip. He did not get enough sleep, did not take a proper nap before he started driving, and he is therefore liable. That has to be negligence. Clearly there's negligence, and he put everybody in jeopardy. So Yashim speak, he didn't sleep enough before him. However, he says, if the accident only occurred at the end, towards the end of the trip, he's been driving all night, and now he fell asleep. I mean, who wouldn't, right? So Ibrahim Ira Haonis, Karab Lesov, and Nasiya Shadelach, everybody falls asleep. The Haya Maspik Low, even if he had slept enough beforehand, my goodness, he's been driving for 10 hours, so of course by now he'll be tired. The Kamakam, he would be, no, Tadema Anashim, It just happens, you know. Ayudena Sia Rukha, a person drives a long time, they're going to get sleepy. And Prabhu Keshka Slai also was driving at night. My goodness, was that Kashli Vosha, Onis Kodokshia? It's hard to call that negligent. So I don't know about this, because I would think that once you're driving for a period of time, if you see that you're getting drowsy, you better pull over. That's why they have motels on the side of the road. Motels, hotels, you can, you know, always just even go for 3-4 hours. A good idea. So I think that there's a stronger argument to say that I could treat it like onus, or even onus gomer, if a person has a stroke. I know somebody who was driving and he had a stroke. He couldn't have anticipated. He wasn't in bad health. He had a stroke, so the car, fortunately, nobody got hurt, which was a miracle. He didn't get hurt. Nobody got hurt. The car just kept on going for it, rolled to a stop. That was like a miracle. But if the car would cause damage in such a case, so I could certainly see from a halakhic perspective that would be onus gomer. Again, it ends up being more of a theoretical discussion, because as I pointed out, generally speaking, when we're talking about car accidents, people are going to be covered by insurance anyway, so it's all going to be determined in terms of the insurance statutes. But it's sort of an interesting discussion anyway. It's an interesting discussion anyway, because you have the whole sugya in Baba Kama Lama and Allah, for example, about one person who's carrying the beam, and the other person is carrying the barrel, and the person who's carrying the beam suddenly stops without any warning, and therefore, of course, it's the person who's carrying the barrel to go into the beam, so then that's going to incur liability as well. We say all these rules that other mu'a of the olam, it's an important distinction, you have this in the Aruch HaShulchan, is when there is the person who's causing the damage is going into the reshus of the person who ends up being damaged. But if they're both like on the highway, they both have permission to be there, and they're both walking in the normal course, so we say that if there wasn't like a direct action of harming the other person, they just knocked into each other, so then generally speaking, they would both be a putter in such a case, because they both had the right to be there. But if one was more negligent than the other, like you have the person who's carrying the beam, the person carrying the barrel, the person carrying the barrel stops for no reason whatsoever, so then he's going to have liability. So the Pesukei Koshin says, so therefore we're going to follow the same principles. We're going to follow the same principles when it comes to car accidents, at least according to strict halacha. According to strict halacha, number one, if you break the traffic rules, so then by definition, you're like the person who stopped for no good reason, because you're being mishane. Anybody who's mishane is going to be chayav. You went against what the rules are. And the Aruch HaShulchan talks about a situation where somebody's driving their car or driving their carriage. He wasn't talking about a car. They're driving their carriage, and then suddenly somebody jumps in front of the carriage. The person driving says, I was driving at the normal speed, and I couldn't have anticipated the person would jump in front of my carriage, so he's not going to be liable in such a case. But if the person jumping in front of the carriage was like a behema or a child who wouldn't know better than to not jump in front of the carriage, then he is going to be liable, unless it's a sort of road where you have no reason to anticipate an animal or a child jumping in front of you. So if you're driving around West Rogers Park, so even if you're driving at a normal speed, but a child jumps in front of you, you have to anticipate the possibility. So you have to drive in such a way, drive as if your kids live here. I think I saw a sign somewhere that said something like that. So you have to anticipate that possibility. You're driving on the highway, you probably don't have to anticipate the possibility that a kid is going to jump in front of your car in the middle of the highway. But those rules of the Aruch HaShulchan, you know, would be would presumably be applicable over here as well. If you take a look, the Aruch HaShulchan is in Source Yudal. Source Yudal, it has this whole discussion in the Aruch HaShulchan if you want to take a look. Okay, so last thing that I wanted to mention is, why are you responsible for your, let's say you're driving and you stop your car all of a sudden without any warning and without any justification, somebody knocks into it and their car ends up being damaged. So halakhically speaking, you should know, Pesukei Koshin talks about, this would be sort of a similar case where you would be liable. Now, some say, no, but the person behind you should always drive in such a way that even if you would stop all of a sudden, they can never go into you. So that's a mitigating consideration. If that's true, so that's a mitigating consideration. That's something to at least think about. Yeah.
What if a person is driving and he consistently breaks a number of laws? And I watched it happen yesterday. He kind of rolling stops all of a sudden, and then he rolling stops at stop signs. Then he actually stops, and the person behind him hits him because he was expecting the rolling stop.
I don't see. So he
saw it yesterday. So the first driver
yeah.
consistently violated the law. Rolling
right.
stops,
right.
various things.
Yeah.
And then he came to an actual correct stop at a stop sign,
and
the guy behind him was expecting the rolling stop and hit him.
I think that you always have to, you know, drive carefully according to, you know, the laws. You can expect that the person will buy, you know, might violate the law, but you also have to expect that maybe they're not going to violate the law. So I don't think that would necessarily be a justification. It's an interesting, you know, question, but you have to always assume that people are going to try to do tshuva. Okay, so no, to tell you, okay. So. Right. You're not supposed to draw, you're not supposed to follow so closely either. Although I find that the worst violators on the road, somehow, at least when they're driving near me, they never seem to get stopped. Like, you ever have that experience? Like, people like zigzagging at 90 miles per hour and there's just no police anywhere in sight? Then
you get stopped.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to discuss is the type of cases where there's property damage. So those do come into the basket. Where somebody happened to cause harm to another person's property, and the question is, how do we evaluate how much should be paid? Like, we had a case where there was a sheitel. Somebody gave in their sheitel to a sheitel macher to be fixed, and the sheitel just ended up being completely ruined. But it was a used sheitel to begin with, so how much was the amount of the damage? And there were other considerations here. Number one, you're dealing with a professional. Maybe you're dealing with a professional, so they're not liable if they do it for free, so they're not liable even, you know, if they made a mistake. If they're getting paid for it, this is a sugya in Gemara Baba Kama, Daf Tzadik Tes. If they're getting paid, so then they are liable for the mistakes that are on, like, the level of Shomer Sachar type of liability of Gneva Vaveda, but not necessarily onus, okay? But let's say that there was, you know, some measure of negligence, and therefore there's going to be responsibility in this case. So the usual standard in terms of evaluating property damage is articulated in the Shulchan Aruch. This is source 15, source Tesvav, okay? Take a look at source Tesvav. Shalom Namaz B'dal G'dek Shalom Lom Hezik Mamono. The same thing. Just like with Nezek, if you cause damage to a person, you chop off their arm, how much were they worth before and how much are they worth now? So here too as well. You cause damage to an animal, okay? So you look at how much was the behemoth worth originally, how much is the carcass worth now? And the same thing with the utensil. How much was the sheita worth originally, how much is it worth now? How much was the car worth originally, how much is it worth now? How much is it worth now that it has been broken? And therefore, and you pay simply the diminution value, not the replacement value, but the diminution in value. So the Chazon Ish famously asked, he said, wait a second, but sometimes the diminution in value is going to be so negligible that you're not going to really be able to get a proper compensation. He says the following, take a look, it's famous Chazon Ish. Baba Kama, Simon Vav, Sif Katan Gimel, if it's not famous, I'm hoping to make it famous now. V'yesh la'ayin, heichi shekilkil, koso beso. Let's say that you threw a stone at a person's wall, or you threw a ball at a person's wall, and you caused damage to the wall. But if you take a look, this is a house that's worth $500,000, and now you cause like a little damage, there's a little nick on the wall, but it's still worth $500,000. But you still did damage to this wall, you broke a window, whatever. Since the house is not, a person lives in a house, they're not in a house as an investment, they're in a house to live in it. So really, what you've damaged is that now they have to fix. In other words, the harm that you caused, they're now going to have to fix. It says the Chazon Ish, whenever it's something that can be fixed, so the amount of damage that has to be paid that the Beis Din calculates is what's the amount that it takes to fix it. And look, if the amount that it takes to fix it is more than the entire value of the item, obviously that's what we're talking about. But if it takes like $50 to fix it, talking about a $500,000 house, so then that will cost $500 to fix it, even though the value of the house hasn't changed. But nonetheless, that's the amount that you would have to pay. And then he quotes a Rashi, and this is sort of interesting because I saw in the Sefer Shari Mishpah, he takes the same Chazon Ish to stand for two different propositions, but it seems to be one proposition. So the Chazon Ish quotes a Rashi, talks about somebody donated a korban to the Beis HaMikdash, and the Kohanim, the Kohen who was offering the korban, did pigul. You know, he caused it to become invalid through his thought process. So now, even if it's an edava, which means it's a korban for which the owner did not take responsibility if something would go wrong with the animal, it wasn't a neder, it was an edava, it was just harezu, so he doesn't have to replace it. Nonetheless, he wanted to bring this korban, and now the korban got messed up. So therefore, the Kohen still has to pay him. Despite the fact that there's no objective loss because he doesn't have to bring another korban, that which it was worth for himself, it was worth something for himself, so that the Kohen harmed. So therefore, that's what the Kohen has to pay. So he has to be, it sounds like the Chazon Ish is bringing this as a proof that there's a tikkun here. Now the tikkun here is going to be that the Kohen has to just give him another behemoth altogether, right? So that he'll be able to, you know, bring bring a different behema as a korban, but it sounds like he's saying that even when there's no objective loss in value, you pay the tikkun. So Sefer Shari Mishpat says that this stands for another proposition, which is that let's say that there was a used item that ended up getting damaged, and it wasn't worth very much to begin with, and now that it's damaged, you know, the loss in value, so it was worth, yeah, it was a suit that was bought for $1,000, now it's used, so what's it worth? Like $50, so now it was damaged, so it's worth, you know, $2. So do we say that the total, you know, that the total damage is only $48, and this person, you know, this was a very valuable suit? Well, let's say it's based on the now you can still sell it for, you know, for $30, but basically it's, you know, not worth very much. So it says, so says the Shari Mishpat, that this Chazon Ish stands for the proposition that you have to look at the value based on what's worth it to the person. I went out and I bought, you know, a new suit yesterday, and today it's only worth half of that. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that the value, if it gets damaged, is based on it only being worth half of what it was worth originally. For me, it's worth almost exactly as much as it was worth when I bought it. There's, I think, an accounting type of mechanism when people, where do I have this written down somewhere? When accountants try to value an item, so they can value it in two different ways. One different way that they can value it is based on just the depreciation of the item, meaning what is the item? One is the depreciation of the item, and it could depreciate very, very, very significantly. But another way in which it can be evaluated is what we call there's useful life and there's present value. So present value takes into account whatever is just the regular depreciation. But useful life says that if I buy something today which is $1,000 and I expect it to last for 10 years, so next year it's going to be worth how much? $900. Not that it's going to be, from a depreciation perspective or a market perspective, maybe I'd only be able to sell it for $400 next year. But from my own satisfaction perspective, it's worth $900. So he focuses on that language of the Chazon Ish to say that maybe that's the way that we should go about the evaluation. I don't know, because it seemed to me that the Chazon Ish was focusing more on the tikkun aspect. How much is it going to cost to be misaking it, to fix it, rather than what is the, you know, subjective value? But I understand how that could be read from the raya that he brought from the case of the Nedava, and he says that that's one another minog that is followed nowadays in terms of a Bezdin evaluation. I'm not 100% sure of that, but if he says it, I believe that it must be the case, but it would be interesting to see if there are any other rias. Bottom line is there is a wealth of different, you know, cases and scenarios that could arise in the Nezikin context. Many, many Nezikin cases don't come to Bezdin nowadays for a variety of reasons. The types of cases that we do have generally are more in the realm of property value, of property damage, rather than physical assault and battery. And when it comes to property damage, it's important to recognize that there are multiple ways of assessing the extent of the damage based on the circumstances, and that we do operate with the principle of adam mu'ad li'olam, that a person who directly causes damage generally bears responsibility. If it's groma, indirect, then they're usually not responsible, but it is nonetheless something which is usur to do if it's indirect. If it's garmi, it's like partially direct, even if it's not 100% direct, so then there can be liability. And a Bez then has to, you know, assess all of these different considerations.
Yes. How about reputation? Does Bez never get, what a horrible Rebbe. He's the worst teacher. Do you ever get law cases?
The general rule with respect to, let's say, Lashon Hara type cases, where there's professional, where there's slander, is that we will hear cases where there is an allegation of professional slander, meaning that there's slander against a person's professional reputation, where it could cause them monetary loss. If it's simply a slander that, you know, a person has been, you know, a woman's, somehow maligned, that they say her children doesn't taste so good, but ultimately it's not going to, she's a lawyer for a living, so it's not really going to affect her professionally. So that's something that should perhaps be taken up with a local rav in order to quell the tensions and to smooth things over with the relevant people, but it's not necessarily a case for a Bezdin adjudication.
But you do get those also?
We certainly do get those also. But
I mean, the monetary.
And if both parties really want, let's say the rav of the community says that I don't feel, you know, it's so comfortable handling this the Lashon Hara dispute, no, so I would like the Beis Din to handle it, and the parties agree, so then we'll handle it. No. But generally speaking, the Beis Din only handles like professional standard type
professional,
cases.
Professional standard type cases,
we have taken and we have heard those types of cases. And, you know, I remember we once had a case where the Rav, who was very upset that he wasn't asked to be Masada Kiddushin for somebody in his community, and then the Rav got up and he gave a whole sermon in which he blasted the person for not asking him to be Masada Kiddushin, and then the person complained that the Rav had slandered him, and the Rav said, well, he had a right to slander him, and the whole community, it was just blowing up the whole community, and they decided that they would bring it to the Beis Din in order to just resolve the dispute and to bring Shalom to the community. So as an accommodation to the community, we agreed to hear that case, and Baruch Hashem, I think we were able to make Shalom. Everybody, you know, said that they understood that, you know, that they made a mistake and they kissed and made up. Okay.
Thank you.